Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yo.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Gentlemen, I am wearing actually, it's hard to tell, but I'm wearing my Blue Origin hat. I just got that. They've opened up their Blue Origin online merch store. And, you know, in my interest of supporting all things related to space, one of the things I purchased, that's their, I don't know if you can see it, that's their emblem, is actually the feather. But I'm going to be wearing my space guy gear pretty nonstop pretty soon because, you know, it's coming up in less than 10 days.
Isn't it a bunch of more Starlink satellites about to launch?
No.
Or the human,
no, Brian. Humans. Big news. The Crew Dragon capsule is going up. The astronauts are already in quarantine for this mission.
Thank goodness.
Fooled
at
you
least
guys.
Some of us so are in quarantine.
Well, yeah. Oh,
okay. Yes. So that's due to launch on May 27th. And actually, there was, Brian, supposed to be a big Starlink launch. I think it was today, but there was weather, so they postponed it until after the Crew Dragon launch. So that's exciting. May 27th, this is going to be the first launch of Americans on board an American spacecraft since the shuttle. And actually, because of the way this works, it's going to do, it will do, they'll go up, they go to the International Space Station, and then when it lands, there's going to be a landing in the ocean. It will be the first time we've landed a craft in the ocean. We've done a splashdown landing since like almost 50 years.
Now, is that going to happen just because we know for sure that's pretty safe? Or is that, I guess, if I were SpaceX, I would probably not want to do the flex of like a pad landing until we, you know, already had that under our belt of sending humans up and bringing them back safely.
Exactly. That was initially the Dragon 2 capsule was going to do a propulsive landing, which was going to use its engines to go land. And then in working with NASA, they realized that NASA's like, hey, we've got a lot of history of parachutes. We know a ton about parachutes. We know reliability of parachutes. This is how we've been returning people either on a runway like the space shuttle or with parachutes. And it kind of comes down to like how much technology do you want to try to attempt at? You know, how much do you want to try to do? And I think it came down to pragmatically, they're like, we'll use parachutes because they've been using those on the regular Dragon capsule. And so SpaceX has a lot of experience with that. So it ended up being, I think, a pragmatic decision.
Probably not a bad symbolic move either. If I could think of worse things than this particular launch having an ending that looks a lot thematically like what we remember from the Apollo missions or what have you. I mean, I don't know how much better it is to add any amount of complexity for, you know, a rocket assisted landing.
Yeah, I think. On one hand, it does feel like, well, great, we're still doing it the way we did 60 years ago. On the other hand, like that way worked really well, and it's very reliable. And, you know, save the propulsive landing for Starship. Save it for, you know, the next generation system where, you know, it's done from the ground up.
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, the two astronauts that are going up, they're old hands, veterans. They're like an old married couple. They're grumpy old men.
Yeah. Ed Behnke and the other gentleman escapes me for the moment. These guys are experienced astronauts. And here's the good news. They're all older than us. So I'm saying there's a chance. That's one of the things that's interesting. When you look at who a lot of the test pilots they've used.
Oh, you mean like, there's a chance for us to eventually go up as well?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought you were saying like there's a chance they won't screw it up. Because as we know, if we did it, it would be a disaster.
Well, that's true, too. That is certainly true, too. Like, you know, one of us, I'm not going to name names, as a kid tried to bring firecrackers through an airport, you know, security detector. So I don't know if he should be trusted to go on a spacecraft.
So the 27th, just what, 1 week, 2 weeks?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, 9 days away.
That's crazy. So
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. It's also, they're discouraging people from actually going to go watch the launch. We'll see. Florida's been open up a bit, so I think you're going to get some crowds there, but they're still saying, hey, let's not pack everybody together. But I think we're going to have excellent coverage. SpaceX's coverage of these events is really extremely well done. So, you know, I'm going to probably be live streaming when this is happening and, you know, chattering on and on about it when they do the launch, because it's an exciting moment. It's really an exciting moment. It's a big step back into, you know, space for us. And also because it's SpaceX and this platform, it means that it's, the cost of this will be substantially lower for other organizations and enterprises that want to try to do this. Like, I think they've already got some like private launch partners lined up, people who want to go, you know, do this. We've seen there's been advertising now for like NASA came out actually with that a sheet that says the breakdown of what it costs to visit the International Space Station.
Would it be a stretch to call this the most luxurious space launch in human history? Because little things like the amount of space around, the amount of comfort of the chairs, the amount of automated systems that you don't have to beep the buttons yourself or whatever. I mean, this is, they're kind of getting to ride the Lexus to space, right?
Oh, yeah. It's designed to seat 7. And so it's going to just be like 2 in there, you know, like, I don't know if they get to choose their own seats or something, you know, like, yeah. I'm just going to lay across the back row here, guys.
Has anyone called dibs? Do we know what the dib situation is?
Yes. Yeah. So if you haven't seen the interiors of the crew capsule, it's neat to take a look at, because it feels more like J.J. Abrams' Star Trek than the right stuff. You know, it's not a bunch of like dials and stuff like this and steel panels and things like manuals. It's all touchscreens. It's all gleaming. It's all, you know, just this very futuristic interior.
I mean, you know, in a weird way, that has to, I would imagine that it would sort of affect my excitement, whereas just like, I don't know, you think about, you know, you watch The Aviator and you picture, you know, Howard Hughes flying one of the flyest prototypes ever. And then it's just like, you know, well, I got on a technically even bigger and faster ship when I took that Southwest Airlines flight, you know, it's a curious thing to me to be like, I mean, on the one hand, you have to be excited for the sheer luxury and simplicity of your experience, but also you have to take a moment to pause to think about the giants upon whose shoulders you're riding right now.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And that's one of the idea of SpaceX versus NASA sort of kind of thoughts is really not helpful, because so much of this is made possible because of, you know, we've spent billions of dollars over the decades in space flight, space research, et cetera, that now SpaceX, Blue Origin, everybody gets to benefit from and build on top of, you know, and, you know, that's, you know, but it all kind of, you know, we got there because some crazy people decades and decades ago spent a lot of late nights drinking coffee trying to solve problems. Some very, very brave people hopped on board these things. And, you know, over time, we kind of, you know, can figure out what the, you know, some of the solve problems are. We're looking at, the two astronauts inside of there testing the control panels. And they're very slick looking SpaceX flight suits, by the way.
I mean, I guess not only the most luxurious ride, but also like the dopest uniforms. I mean, come on.
Well, this is the first glimpse into the future. This is the first glimpse into a world in which these kind of things are going to be far more not only prevalent, but also, as Andrew said, cheaper for, you know, to get NASA. I mean, this is really what we have kind of wanted in all the times that we've talked about SpaceX. The biggest thing that we kind of were always working toward was this idea that NASA could get back to letting exploration be the mission and not manufacturing. And now that we have gotten to a point where they can send humans, like, that's it. That's the full menu. That's what you want for NASA to have. And it's great that SpaceX is there, and hopefully we continue to get even more options.
Yeah, that's what's really exciting, because we have Blue Origin, Sierra Nevada, which they were building the sort of like kind of the looked like sort of the mini space shuttle, you know, which I think they're going to be doing for cargo. And that's just an exciting thing to think about, getting to the point where we have multiple launch providers doing that. And then if, you know, Starship gets to work, be very cool. Look at the Sierra Nevada thing. It's a very cool looking thing. Of course, that's kind of where the Bionic Man had his problem, and why, you know, he had to have his powers. But if you look at the design of it. Remember the opening of the Bionic Man? They actually showed there was a footage from an actual, like it was the dinosaur, which was this, you know, this early lifting body spacecraft prototype. And that was a thing that spiraled out of control and crashed.
Oh, I totally thought it was one of the X series of high altitude craft. I didn't realize it was that one.
Yeah. I think that's what Buck Rogers was in too. So listen, you know, it doesn't bode well for the success of a mission, but really cool if you're on TV series to hop on board one of those early prototypes.
We can get two men for the cheap, cheap price of only $6
million. $6 million, man.
We're going to be thrilled.
Yeah, it's called Grandma's Hip Replacement now.
Yeah.
Hey, Bryce, you mentioned you had some stories too.
Yeah. Is anybody hungry? Right. I know we're in the middle of the show right now, and so maybe this is a little inverted, but I'm kind of feeling a little peckish.
I just had some pizza, two slices.
Yeah, I just had a little bit of a couple of hard-boiled eggs, but I'm all right.
I had some eggs. I'm getting up on it. You know, probably in the next couple hours, I'll be a little hungry for a snack.
I you know, pizza sounds like a good idea. You know, I'm gonna open up a Grubhub and maybe order myself a pizza here.
About that. Wow, okay, that seems cool. Really unprofessional. We're in the middle of a show, Bryce.
Unless he's ordering actual grubs and they're in a hub and he's calling it a pizza, in which case it's very on brand.
Yeah. Hey, this is a horrifyingly boring. Call. Yeah. This is so bad. Bryce, are you jackknifing the show?
Well, it's just, you know, I want to get a pizza, but I want to get like a good one, right? You don't want to get like the big brands, because I'm using the apps. They're expensive, right? But there looks like there's one here, Pasquale's Pizza and Wings. You guys ever hear of this?
Pasquale's
Pizza and Wings.
I heard the word wings. Good enough for me.
You guys want some wings?
Yeah.
All right, here, I'm just gonna All right, I've got a pepperoni pizza and some buffalo wings coming in.
Duh.
My driver has texted me a picture of the food, but there's an issue. This doesn't seem to be. I thought this was kind of getting a local thing.
Would you say that a musical, that maybe there's a promise of fun and frivolity and music with this particular order, Bryce?
It appears that I'm going to get a lot. I would expect maybe a little fun and games with apparently where they've sourced this from. So
Bryce, if you were to react to this order using only movements of your eyes, how would you react to this order?
It would be like this.
That's good pizza. that's great pizza.
Wait a minute. Is this a Chuck E. Cheese thing? Have they rebranded? Are they selling Chuck E. Cheese through Grubhub?
So Chuck E. Cheese is one of the many companies right now doing virtual kitchens with a new brand, Pasquale's Pizza and Wings. And so they are available nationwide wherever you get Chuck E. Cheese's from. But if you go on Grubhub or DoorDash or these things, you will, instead of seeing Chuck E. Cheese, you will see Pasquale's Pizzas and Wings, as one Philadelphia order user was shocked to find out.
Bryce, do you have the corporate statement? The corporate statement was amazing, because very obviously this is a situation where Chuck E. Cheese is thought of as the destination that children want to go to, and it's not because their pizza is great. It's because your kids are there that you have to order it. So nobody wants to order the pizza at home, right? Even parents, they can't satiate their kids with this pizza at home. So they got to figure out something to do with these kitchens, something to do with these workers. But they also don't want to crap on their menu.
Yes.
So listen to just the gymnastics that are done in this statement.
Pasquale's Pizza and Wings, named after another favorite member of Munch's make-believe band, shares kitchen space with the Chuck E. Cheese restaurant, ensuring high-quality, fresh ingredients. Pasquale's Pizza and Wings' recipes use fresh homemade pizza dough, just like Chuck E. Cheese, but it is a different pizza that features a thicker crust and extra sauce, giving consumers a more flavorful, more premium pizza experience. While Pasquale's Pizzas and Wings recipes are currently only available for delivery, select items might be added to the Chuck E. Cheese menu in the future. they can finally make them good.
I have no problem with this at all. Like, we ordered from a local, like there's a new pizza place, open up a local one. There's only like two or three of them, whatever, yesterday. I waited It took him an hour longer to deliver than it should have taken. I got the pizzas, one of those big pizzas, like, oh, it's, you know, it's New York style. The sauce was so watery and stuff. It was okay. But I'm like, I preferred my Papa John's or my Domino's, you know? And it all comes down to if Chuck E. Cheese wants to sell pizzas under another name. If you get the pizza and you like the pizza, great.
Yeah. And I don't know for sure whether or not Chuck E. Cheese is a top-down run thing or if they franchise out. But look, there's a lot of jobs. We can make jokes about like, ah, ha, ha, Chuck E. Cheese is selling stuff, you know, out of their kitchen. But like, look, there's a lot of people that work there. Nobody wants to see them get fired. So I'm fine with them doing it. I think it's a great idea. I would almost hope that they get more experimental. I think it's funny that they have to, write a statement saying like, no, this is premium. Not that the other stuff was bad. Like, this is good though, but this could be good on Chuck E. Cheese's menu too. But I think it's fine. I love the idea of headless, restaurants that are just running out of kitchens. I think it's that you should do more of it. The more options I get on those apps, the better, the happier I am.
Yeah. Did you guys fire up your indignance outrage engines when there was some pranksters that created ghost kitchens that were just microwaving, you know, out of the box meals? Because I know the point is like, hey man, I'm spending $30 and getting it delivered, and this is a $4 lasagna that from a hotel or whatever.
That sounds frustrating.
I weirdly had no problem with it at all. Well, none whatsoever.
Yeah, and also, if you've worked in food service or had friends there, like you know, some of these places, you go back in the kitchen and you see where the, you know, particularly like a place like an Applebee's or Fridays. Guess what, folks? It's coming out of a freezer, going into a microwave, then onto your table, you know? And I think we conceptually get the whole idea like, oh, I thought some poorly underpaid person slaved hours to make this food. I'm upset, you know. I think that one of the things exciting about more of the headless kitchens or the cloud kitchens is that food delivery, the problem with food delivery right now is there's all these articles about how much money like Uber Eats has lost and Grubhub's lost hundreds of millions of dollars. And there's a great article out about a guy doing pizza arbitrage because his friend who had a pizza place that wasn't listed, but like DoorDash or somebody like this was selling his pizzas, but for $10 cheaper than he was selling them for, because apparently what they were doing was a test run of getting how many orders they could get for him, then go at him and say, look what we're doing. And so what he just started doing was buying his own pizzas, putting dough in there, you know, to see how long it would run. But I think a thing that could be a big impactful is to think about portion size changing. Right now, when you order from a restaurant, it's sort of the idea is that you order a portion that's going to come to your table, and I'm willing to pay more for a bigger thing delivered to my house so that I have food for several days.
Oh, it'll last a little while.
And I think that would be, I think, because then you're willing to pay more because the value proposition, like we order from Denny's every week because like we're friends with the staff there and whatnot. And Denny's now will do grocery delivery too. Like we can order like cold cuts and stuff like that, which for the most part has been great. Sometimes we've got some stuff that's expired, not so great. But, you know, I like the idea though, like, oh, order these other things. So when you spend 70, 80 bucks on food, you're getting enough to last you a long while. You don't have that, like, I hate ordering. Like, I hate ordering from some place. You spend like 50 bucks and you get like two entrees and you're done. And you're like,
yeah,
I'm still hungry.
Especially with like the delivery fees on top and processing and tips, you know.
Yeah, I think that there's a ton of options here. Like, there, and maybe now is the point where restaurants will be more into the idea of taking chances on stuff. But I think, normalizing kind of like double portions or portioned out foods where you're getting like a set of things that are pre-portioned out for three meals. And so now you're maximizing that delivery. I've long wanted to have some kind of restaurant subscription for restaurants that Ashley and I would go to a fair amount of time where we could maybe get a little bit more as long as, you know, we're paying upfront for what we would get, and the restaurant can understand that there's X amount of money coming in. I think we are ripe on all fronts for figuring out how we can maximize kitchens and maximize physical real estate, because, you know, one of the things I think that is going to come out of here, whether we like it or not, is that the virtual genie is out of the bottle. This is kind of like when you realized you could download an album on Napster. Whether or not you think it's right and whether or not you think it's good, the technology is validated now, and we see that we can live off it. And it is just going to change things forever.
Yeah.
Was it Napster? Let me look this up. This is, sounds cool. I'm gonna try this.
No, it's down now. You have to get Grokster or
LimeWire.
You know, okay.
LimeWire. Yeah.
Downloader with an R. There are a few more here that I found while looking up the story. Do you guys know Neighborhood Wings? Who do you think Neighborhood Wings is?
I have thoughts. Okay, go ahead. Please tell me these are not homemade wings, because homemade wings are all garbage. As we know, true wings have to be in a deep fryer that's not been cleaned in a month.
Okay. Well, so, Neighborhood Wings, I guess, is the name of another one of these headless restaurants. What do you think the big chain is?
So somebody is now selling wings out of a place that wouldn't normally sell wings.
You could get wings at this place.
Is that what we're going for here?
That wings are on the menu here.
Stringtown Road, Georgeville Square Drive. Probably not somebody's house. Probably Domino's?
Good guess, Domino's. Okay.
KFC?
KFC. All right, that's closer. Justin, you got a final guess?
Popeyes?
Hooters.
No. That Neighborhood Wings is 2020 Stringtown Road is Applebee's.
Whoa!
Applebee's.
I would be more interested in their other headless concept, just rib tibs.
You mentioned
Stringtown Road sounds made up.
Yeah, you mentioned Hooters. Hooters does run a virtual kitchen. Do you know the name of their virtual kitchen?
Wings and nothing else. Wings without responsibility. Fly free on these wings. They have no baggage with them.
Okay, it's a little
wings
conceptual.
From an old man who delivers them with a twinkle in his eye and a grizzled spirit. Wings.
We're looking for Hootie's Burger Bar.
Oh God!
Hootie's Burger Bar, a virtual kitchen inside of Hooters. Not even
blowfish unavailable.
I'll tell you what. I mean, I'm for all of this. Whatever keeps that kitchen humming, whatever keeps everybody being able to make money delivering it, like, I think that's such a smart idea. And also, I just hope it means that there's more different kinds of stuff. Like the better that we're able to order this, and then there's the whole next level of trying to figure out, you know, optimizing price and delivery time and how to maximize your money there. I think it's a great idea.
Here's a way to look at it is that in the real world, if you open up a restaurant, you call it a name like, I'm going to be, you know, the Center Pizzeria, you know, you're stuck with that. Okay. And let's say maybe you have really good food or you're under new management, the quality is improved, but people still think you're the same thing. Or maybe you have an item, maybe you make a really good pasta too, but nobody ever goes there for your pasta. So, and you can't, it's how do you, you're like, well, and we'll get one of those like blow up little guys that wave in the wind and say, and pasta too. You're stuck, you know, in the online world, we can change avatars and our names in a minute. You know, we can change our brand as quickly as we want. So giving brick and mortar and even franchises the ability to say, hey, here's a different version of what you can do. You know, and so many of the restaurants that we go to are actually part of these conglomerates where the food stuff supplies come from the same places.
Yeah, like you know, you look at Cargill. Cargill provides all of the food for pretty much everyone. It's like, what are we running today? Oh, we're running KFC. All right, so that means set the machines to this depth of thickness, set the nuggets to this much, make sure to run this recipe. Wait, it's the end of the week. Now we're running McDonald's. Okay, set the machines to this, and then off they go.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's a guy whose name isn't he probably should be more famous than this, is Paul Fleming. And he is the guy who created so many, a lot of these, you know, big restaurants that you're familiar with, like, you know, P.F. Chang's. It's Paul Fleming, and a guy, Chang, was like Paul Fleming, Fleming Steakhouse. I think he was this guy, I think he started Outback. And you start looking at Paul Fleming and like all of the different sort of places that he started, you realize this guy is like a lot of these start from one person says, oh, what if we specialize on this? What if we focus on this?
Wow. Yeah. That's super cool. So keep an eye out.
That's so funny. It's so funny that's the case. And yeah, I think the idea that restaurants are able to kind of like SEO optimize, especially considering where the apps are now, because restaurants will just like be on an app and then be gone because they'll go exclusive on some other app. So you're used to things kind of being there, going away, showing up. Like it really does give you the opportunity that if Hootie's Burger Bar doesn't resonate, then you could just say best damn Texas burger barn. And if people want to buy from that more, then that can work. But it doesn't mean that they don't have to get new signs at the cost of maybe designing a new logo. They can, in the minds of this gigantic exploding consumer base, just be a different company, which is insane.
Which, by the way, I don't think is an overstatement to say that's the hard part. Like the actual delivery of foodstuffs and adding of spices or whatever, as much as we fetishize as consumers that's the real magic, it's the real magic is the storytelling that goes into launching a brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, yeah, and specifically for restaurants, you know, your real estate is so expensive and you want to make sure that there is a consistency. So it's like, you know, you're very rarely going to go from like, all right, we're a tapas place, but we have this pasta dish that people really like and people really, really like that as an appetizer. Boy, they would have to love it as an appetizer for you to say, hell, we should just do all pasta stuff, right? Like that's not going to be something that usually happens in that scenario. But in this one, if you just see, oh crap, no one's getting our tapas, they're only getting the pasta appetizer, you could just the next day be like, where are the pasta men? Come buy our pasta. And it's ready to roll.
And I think part of why this Chuck E. Cheese story blew up is there's weird branding around it. Like we looked at the
rats. Is that the problem? The fact that they're constantly advertising how many rats are at their establishment.
They're not even acknowledging the music. What is it? The music band extended universe. There's a whole wiki about the entire.
Do you know why they had the rat?
If I recall correctly, it was some story where they ordered a thing and it looked awful. And they just were like, that looks more like a rat. And they're like, I guess we roll with it being a rat.
It was Nolan Bushnell. Was it some like, you know, because he was at while running Atari, had the idea of like, let's have our own pizza place with video games. Maybe people wait for pizzas so that kids can play video games. And we'll have a mascot because he saw the Disney Tiki Hut with it. He said, my guys could build that. And he goes to this, you know, costume trade show and he sees a costume, says, oh, this is perfect, sends it back to the R&D guys and calls them up a couple weeks later, goes, hey, how's it coming, how's the animatronic coming? Like, oh yeah, the rat's coming along great, but we break, you know, marketing wants to talk to you about why you chose a rat. He goes, rat, I thought I bought a fox, because he was gonna be like Fox's, you know, Funtime Pizza or something. They're like, no, you sent us a rat costume. He's like, oh, okay. And so then the branding people are like, well, we got it. We think we figured out, like, we have a name that has two smiles, you know, or three smiles. It's Chuck E. Cheese. And he says, I love it. So it was the trying to solve the branding disaster when Nolan Bushnell sends you a rat costume.
That's so funny.
Not for nothing. That sounds like an apocryphal made up after the fact thing. But it's like all three of our children, we chose their names because either in the long form or in the short form, it tricks you into saying their name with a smile. Callie, Josie, Penny, Calliope, Josephine, Penelope.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's cool. That's beautiful.
But I think part of why this is also being a story is you have to, you know, in terms of like we're talking about the branding, right? Like you have to sell this to people, right? You know, we looked at the favor page for Hooties and it says like, this is a virtual kitchen for Hooters. I think I would certainly feel confused if I bought a pizza thinking it's Pasquale's, a local place. And like for the Philadelphia woman who ordered pizza, like there is a pizza place called Pasquale's that is a local place. And it comes in a Chuck E. Cheese box. I'm going to go, what the hell is going on here? Why?
Tokens. Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. I would feel, would you feel at least a little taken advantage of, especially now when like a lot of the apps are like, if you order local, you get you know, we're trying to help local, save
it,
local.
It would definitely local. Be a mistake to surprise anyone with a Chuck E. Cheese branded box, but it would be fairly affordable to have it be a neutral box. And it's like, man, all I know is I want Pasquale's, and it showed up faster than anyone else, and it sure was pizza. Like, yeah, that seems fine.
Yeah, the support local thing, to me, there's a difference between me having something mail order from out of town versus place A and place B. Place A has 8 employees who all live in my community. Place B has 8 employees who all live in my community. Place A, 8% of the profits go somewhere else. Place B, you know, they're not as much efficiently run. So 2% of the profit goes to somebody who lives here. And it's like, I'm keeping people employed who work here. You know,
Look, Chuck E. Cheese's is a franchise. So I'm looking it up here. It takes a little over $1 million to $2 million to just get the franchise, right? And then another $1 million in liquid assets to run it. Like, this is a local business. It's a local business with a national brand, but that doesn't mean that there's not somebody in your neighborhood or reasonably in your neighborhood regionally that is running these things. And like the guy who works at the kitchen in Chuck E. Cheese, there ain't no difference between him and the guy who works at the local pizzeria. So I'm fine with it, mostly because I just want people to have jobs. It doesn't matter to me where the ownership is on this.
Not to pour stereotypes, I'd argue chances are the guy working at the local one may be paid under the table and possibly related to the owner.
Yeah, right.
Yes, he's 12. We get it.
We'll work for tokens.
But also, like, worth noting, I think you could make a case that the pizza you receive under these new I'll use air quotes when I say faux brand names, is a factually superior experience because it allows them to deviate from the recipes that were designed to maximize output and last the longest under heat lamps or whatever. But also, two pizzas, let's say they're perfectly identical, just knowing that one is a Chuck E. Cheese is going to physically cause you to enjoy that one less. So it's like they're literally improving the pizza by bothering to come up with another name for it.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of where I landed. It's like, if you're gonna do it, you can't let people know. Or if the whole point is this, we're using a different name, then yeah, it can't come in a Chuck E. Cheese bag and it can't come in a Chuck E. Cheese box. And I don't know what you do for the drivers. The drivers probably don't care, but
I think you could, if it would be a bit of a more delicate dance, but let's say it came in all that stuff, but maybe there was like a post-it note over it, you know, that like, this was made to you by Chad, Edgar, Susan and Thomas, second year sophomores at whatever place.
Charles E. Cheeseman.
We're using this kitchen. We're so thrilled that we're somehow able to make you like I don't care. Like tell me a story that involves maximum truth. And the truth is we're using the Chuck E. Cheese kitchen, but throw some character on it. Let me know why I should dig it. And it's like all of a sudden I could feel super good about it, even if it's roughly the same quality.
Yeah, I think a lot of this touches on a book that Brian, you recommended and I read, which I loved, which is Alchemy by Rory Sutherland. And he talks about kind of bullshit. You have to have a certain amount of bullshit, which creates this, you know, makes people like a thing.
Yeah.
You
know? Or at least gets them to recategorize the type of experience that they're having from it.
I don't know. I just think about when I'm using those apps and I'm ordering stuff, I tend to not want to order from Big Ben, even if it's a franchise, even if it's whatever. Just partly because of the cost, the markup on that stuff. So,
you're paying for the branding and the name and the
and
shareholders
and just the action of doing it, right? Like, I don't mind going to Taco Bell myself, but if I order tacos from a place and they're definitely Taco Bell tacos, I would be like, well, I could have just gone and picked those up and saved the $20 of all the stuff on top of it. You know,
I paid like almost $50 last night for one pizza from a local place, and like it wasn't bad, but I'm like, man, if I'd ordered from Domino's or whatever, I would have had like 3 different pizzas, and you know, my girlfriend would have got her barbecue pizza, I would have got my thing, I would have got this, mm-hmm. you know, and so it varies, you know. Sure. Like,
sure. Yeah, ultimately, I think it's up to you and your own habits. I just hope there's enough action to go around, because these restaurants are definitely hurting.
Do we have time for one more thing? I got an interesting thing. I know you guys already saw this. You're big Idol heads. You love American Idol. You all love saw
it.
This.
Love it. Yeah.
I thought you were saying we were Idol heads. Like, there's nothing going on upstairs. And I'm like, can't agree more.
We're big stupid
Idol heads. Just Steamboat
Willie. Steamboat Willie is playing through my head.
I'm folding proteins. I'm doing the pipe animation.
Well, your word's not mine. So,
blind toasters.
So last night on the season finale of American Idol, Katy Perry performed a new song from her new album Daisies, and we're looking at the video here. They're still finishing up American Idol, doing some of the remote stuff, but she went in somewhere to film this. Justin, can you kind of describe what we're looking at here?
Yeah, this is a big video set, so a gigantic video wall that's kind of folding toward the camera, and the floor that she is on is also a video floor, American Idol logo with the streams of light shooting toward the camera as Katy Perry in a pink dress is singing, but there are, I guess, big virtual elements to the set that are kind of at play. So it looks like this is a gigantic green screen where the world is sort of changing around
there,
her.
There was a hot second that I would have absolutely mistaken this for just a straight up regular height of pre-COVID American Idol performance. And then suddenly it became Lazy Town, and we're about to learn that it's a piece of cake to bake a pretty cake.
No, it looks great though. This is such a great way to try to do something that looks bigger and better in a world where you don't have a ton of backup dancers. And Katy Perry's always been known for her high production values and her videos and stuff like that. So I think this is great. This is awesome. And also a way to kind of disguise that she's not really as mobile, because I think she's pregnant right now.
She's pregnant. That's right. Yeah, I think this is interesting. This aired last night, and so there's not a whole lot of information about it. There was a quote that she gave a few days ago that said she was describing recording this, because obviously this was all pre-recorded. They didn't do it live. And she said, you know, I went into the studio. They recorded me on a big green screen. I went in, I did it, and then I left, kind of talking about the remoteness and the social distancing of it all. But to me, I'm curious of how they did this, whether this was a big green screen. You know, you can do a big green screen and track it all. And you know, if it's Hollywood, they can light it right and make it look good. And she said the word green screen, but this kind of looks more like the big video wall thing that they did for like The Mandalorian, right? Where you have the high density video and you can use lighting and controls to make it look accurate. You know, I think, and so I don't know. I'm of two minds of what this actually is.
The video wall, the Unreal, that which is like based on the Unreal Engine, which is really incredible, which they use for Mandalorian, are using more. One of the telltale things you notice about that is how good it is for lighting, because overhead, part of the video wall is directly overhead, and you get lighting, really significant lighting changes. Where here, she seems pretty consistent. So I think this is just green screen with motion tracking.
Yeah. That's what I would bet. It's well done though. It looked great. Her
well
performance,
done.
Her performance is you know, super fun and convincing that things are getting smaller, that she's actually on the edge of something. But big ups to Katy Perry for putting in the effort, because I think now there's a lot, especially when, like, you know, the ABC is doing good numbers with, you know, stars in front of their webcams just singing Disney songs. This is the first time that I've seen something in a post-COVID world where I'm like, oh, look, effort. Like, a lot of effort went into this. This is really cool.
Yeah, I'd be curious how long I don't know if maybe there was already elements of this in there, but I wonder how quickly viewers will get accustomed to the idea that, you know, press F to pay your respects and it shows up as some amount of digital applause. And yeah, we know those aren't real people applauding in the moment, but we know that these are real people by the thousands hitting, you know, space bar or F or what have you to cause those sounds to happen.
You know, that's a big question right now with, you know, people are talking about sports coming back. And there was a news story that Fox was saying that when the NFL football comes back, they're going to pipe in sound. But some of the backlash to it is like, well, what if you actually just, you know, had some kind of representation of actual fans on their phones?
Yeah, like a Twitter fire hose that was basically kind of aligned to, you know, what you would expect to hear live.
Yeah.
Because I know I've seen some videos. I know a long time ago, maybe even on the show, I showed some of the really cool real time video effects that some of the research groups in Japan are doing with TV stuff, and I think they could definitely do something very similar to that if you set it up right and you figure out how all that works. You know, it's a big,
you know, you thing. You could also, we've seen sort of middle ground where, like, you know, Christopher Titus did his comedy special where I think he had maybe 10 people in the room, just enough to give some kind of feedback to where he was landing or whatever. I don't know that I would mind it if I knew for a fact that there were 10 people there, but there was a filter being run that would interpolate those reactions to roughly simulate the sound of 150 people or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, where it's like jokes that land and 9 out of the 10 people are laughing. You get the sound of 140 complete with some people kind of clapping and so on. I think we could get used to that.
I realized one day I had this sort of epiphany, or somebody said, "Do you watch this show?" I'm like, "No." I'm like, "Oh yeah, because they have a laugh track." Like, I don't laugh. Like, no, I don't. I haven't watched a sitcom with a laugh track in probably like 10 years. And anytime somebody recommends a show to me, and they don't use laugh tracks as much anymore, but that's just always been my thing. Is like, anytime they have to go in there to make that stuff, you listen to the shows with laugh tracks. Without the laugh tracks, you realize how unfunny they are. There's a whole article too about the guy who invented the laugh track, like the whole machine that did this, and the applause thing. It's fascinating because he had this. They had these like live shows, and he built this machine, and they would pay him to show up there with this thing and plug it in the sound system and press the different keys for that. And it was like this big, huge secret, you know, sort of technology.
Hmm. Oh wow! So they were doing it live, like they were. Yeah. He was hitting the laugh buttons in the room. That's crazy. I always thought it was post production
because they had a thing where. They had like the story was, I forget like what some talk show, whatever was, they had a guy who was doing some sort of kind of slightly off color kind of humor. He was like a Catskill comedian or something like this. And the audience laughter was tremendous. They couldn't use the bit on the show, but they recorded the audio of the laughter. And like, that was used for a lot of shows, you know, like a lot of like, appearing, you know, like a lot of like laugh tracks for years was that. And that's like, I remember as a kid listening to watching the Brady Bunch.
It became like the Wilhelm scream of laughter.
Oh, Brady Bunch, you could hear that. There was always at one point you'd hear this woman go, ah, in the laughter. They go, ha, 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 ha. And I was like, ah, that's honey. There's, why is that woman always doing that? And then I'm like, little yeah. Andrew Brain's like, she's paid to do that.
Well, and I think we as humans crave that dynamic enough that right now we're in a backlash against it because we don't want to feel duped or faked or what have you. But if something were algorithmically able to, we had some kind of psychological anchor to know that it's like, well, this is based on some number of people reacting in the moment they're live. I think we could do some mental gymnastics and be okay with it.
Maybe, but remember too that laugh tracks sort of hide bad comedy because you get spaces, you do less jokes. And because you do a joke, because with laugh tracks, you have to stop to let the moment for the laughter fade and then the next joke and the next joke. And when you don't have laugh tracks, it tends to be more rapid fire. You know, it's bump, 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 bump. And you can kind of keep, and I think that, I just know for me, like when I watch shows that have laugh tracks, like the last show that I think I liked with that was probably like Seinfeld, but I would bet that it wouldn't be hard to make Seinfeld work without a laugh track.
Yeah, the middle ground is, and I'm glad that they've largely fixed it, but like watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, there was the first few episodes without an audience, he was definitely waiting the same amount of time for where the laughs were supposed to go, and I didn't care for it at all. And he eventually kind of adjusted the pacing so that he moves punchier. It feels a little bit closer to, you know, a YouTube think piece or whatever. But I don't know that it's better without the live audience, you know, because.
Well, that you may just be addressing a point about the quality, too, because you know, that's one of the things too. It's like when you go watch a taping of, let's say, like a like an Ellen or something like this, they have an audience manager who gets out there in front of it and gets that audience worked up into a frenzy, right? So because and it's got absurd now too, because like everybody gets a standing, you know, every host gets a standing ovation when they come out on the stage like they're Pavarotti. It just becomes ridiculous. And if you're separated from that, you look at this and you're like, this just looks stupid and silly, because this is just manufactured hype to make me excited about something that's not as funny. And you take some of those people, some of those late night show hosts who are now having to work without the cued audience, you know, without the audience with the applause sign and somebody pumping them to do this sort of stuff. And they're not as funny as a lot of other people who have podcasts and TV and YouTube channels.
Yeah, well, and I think we 100% agree. And I think what I'm saying is like let's say I've, one of the most egregious examples I could think of is seeing like the Wendy Williams show, where all I know of that show, because I never hear the audio on, is that there's a good 5 minutes of her walking out and have everyone clap to her. And so I don't know that that show is made any better absent that 5 minutes of everyone clapping for her.
Yeah.
So I understand the value of something being in there.
Mm-hmm. And then yeah. There's also like, filmed in from a live studio audience, which would be different than a laugh track, right? Like,
well, they usually unless they say it, they usually sweeten it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and also I think oftentimes to the benefit of the story, you know, we've talked before about when the last time I did the Tonight Show, the bit I did ended on a confusing enough note that in the moment it felt awkward, but they sweetened it by letting everyone at home know, no, that was the joke. That was the whole bit, was that he was supposed to look like he stabbed himself in the hand. So in that regard, I'm very thankful for the sweetening. And I think, I guess what I'm coming to is, how are we going to sweeten in a post-COVID age?
Yeah, I mean, because like talking about Wendy Williams, right? Like she, as far as I know, they just like film her hanging out every day, and it looks really sad.
Oh, is that what they're doing now, or what they always did?
I've seen a couple of clips, and it looks very sad. Yeah. But it could, you know, it's a daily talk show. I don't know. I don't even watch it when it was already on. I don't know what it looks like. But there's.
I'm gonna be curious to see like how what this hybrid is. Like once the talent and the crew are allowed back in to shoot it. Right. And let's assume that everything is appropriately socially distanced and that's fine. There's a standard of health that they can meet, but there's no way you can have an audience, and you certainly can't have an audience with, you know, people that are as close to each other with the normal kind of volume. Everyone's going to have to evolve. Everyone's going to have to kind of adjust their show a little bit. I'm curious.
I think we're going to go through a phase where stuff will look an awful lot like The Soup or some of the early tech TV programming.
I was just going to say, like The Soup, and you hear the staff laughing.
Yeah.
You know, it feel that's somehow feels...
I want my job. I want to keep my job.
Well, no, but at least...
it feels intimate in a weird way.
Yeah, and then maybe you add the idea that, you know, maybe we get a little bit more podcasty where there's a couple of people with soundboards to where when something does get funny, you know, they give a bam, 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 whatever, you know, it's like, granted, we're only dealing with so many people. I mean, I think there's,
yeah, it really depends on the show, right? Like what is the energy you want to have? Like for Wendy Williams, it is your like sassy friend who's going to say that thing that you know she shouldn't. Like, and so like, what is the best version of that? Like The Soup was great because, you know, even going back to like the like Greg Kinnear, John Henson version of that, there was this, it was really kind of born of this like slacker Gen X ethos of like, like we all, like, let's be honest, we all watched these shows during the day because we don't have a job. So let's make fun of it. And that was when it was more about the Sally Jesse Raphaels and the Springers of the world. As soon as reality television came out, there was like a different, it was a little bit less, hey, we're all obviously unemployed, and more, hey, we're all obviously attracted to reality television. Let's, you know, join in. So there's an element of outcast built, you know, just baked into that bread that makes the self you know, poking at the host, poking at like, hey, we don't have a live audience. We only have our staff. Like that, like, plays into it. But I think everyone's going to have to think about that. Like, the Soup had to think about that because they didn't have people. So it was like, how do we make, you know, this seem as big and fun as possible? And I think everyone's going to have to do it, which is rad. Yep. Son of a bitch.
Hey, everybody.
I'm pretty sure I'm the only one without a laugh track here. God damn it.
Oh, I want the Olsen twins. Oh, isn't that what he said? Aww. Cute.
Or spicy kiss.
Ooh. Oh, no, that
I
was,
put
that
this
was my
photo
favorite
in the microwave.
One of the only Family Guy joke that I remember is that they were doing, it's one of those cutaways of like all your favorite laugh track sounds. And so it was like laughter, like, you know, a child does something adorable. Then it was like, kiss, woo, ethnic kiss, woo. But it was just like,
when did Family Guy start
for whatever reason,
jokes?
The kisses. Yeah, the kisses were always louder. The reactions were always louder on Martin than they were on Step by Step.
Yeah.
Step by Step. Yeah.
Yeah. Joni loves Chachi. Gentlemen, one of your picks?
Yeah, man, I got a weird one. I'm watching a 6-hour playthrough of The Last of Us, the video game for the PlayStation. We're about an hour in. Spoiler alert, at some point a guy finds out that there's a person who is special and needs to be taken to a place far away. That's as far as we are. If you've never seen it, give yourself the first 20 minutes because it is one of the most powerful opening 20 minute anythings in any narrative, anything that I've experienced. You played through this, right, Bryce?
Yeah, it's been a while. But I might watch this because I think that they have a new date for Last of Us, and I think that's in June.
Yeah, they also do a trick where you begin thinking, oh, these must be the characters I play, and then they're not. And lot of time passes, and it's a fairly stark, bold, terrifying, amazing thing. Probably doesn't help that it takes place literally in Southwest Austin and that I recognize some of the roads that they're driving on. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. And we've talked about watching movie cuts of games before, like Last of Us, which is already this big cinematic narrative game, like works perfectly for it. I remember after playing it, when you play it, you could unlock the cutscenes and they had a mode where you could just play all the cutscenes. And I always wanted to go back and see, well, does that tell the whole story? Could you just do that again?
The version I'm watching is the one you pulled up. It's about 6 hours long, something marathon version. So there's a little bit of gameplay happening, but it's when people are sort of whispering significant plot points about, you know, whether it's the way the bad guys work or, you know, how the cover dynamics work, that kind of stuff.
At a brief glance, this 6-hour one is 2 or 3 times longer than many of the other ones I found. So if that's nice. Too long, there are even some shorter ones out there for you.
It's fascinating that the budgets for video games now, like big ones like this, will surpass motion pictures. And there's enough ancillary content in the production of this thing to have 6 hours of this whatever. And it is this sort of thing. Like, I think once we get a grip on what aspects of narrative storytelling that can come from video games that can work in that way, whatever, of like, you know, the next time, you know, we launch some big, huge video game sort of franchise, the idea that almost, you know, default is like, oh yeah, and this will be the Netflix series, whatever, that comes out of it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause they're going to do that for HBO or The Last of Us.
Yeah.
Right. That was announced a month or so ago that they're going to, yeah. So that's pretty cool.
It's insane.
Justin, you got a pick?
Yeah, it's finished now. The Last Dance, ESPN's 10-episode documentary about the Bulls team of 1997 or 98, but more specifically about just that entire group. Most notably, of course, Michael Jordan. It goes back in time. Let me just say this. I'm glad that this came out now, because in a world without entertainment, This was a great communal experience and obviously did gigantic numbers on ESPN. If it had come out in a world where everything existed, I feel like it would have been criticized for being overstretched. And I do think it would probably be, it would have been an incredible 5 episodes. Instead, it's a very luxurious 10, some of which are far more interesting than others.
Yeah, I only made it, I started watching it last night and made it almost to the end of the first episode. And it was just so steeped in remember when or taking me back there that it felt just enough like work that I am sure there's payoffs down the road. But I ended up watching someone play a video game instead for the rest of the evening.
Yeah, that's funny because the first episode is supposed to be there to bring people who are not super dialed in on these stories already in, which I just like, man, there are some themes that if you tightened everything up and you made it just about Michael Jordan and you made it just about, this season and made it ground it far more in the season, you could have done something explosive, but it's 10 episodes because they got paid to do 10 episodes, and that is what it is.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I got a pick. I think I certainly talked about this when it came out, but I finally finished it, and I'm glad I did. I was already enjoying it, and then watching the last episode, I enjoyed it much, much more. That is the Netflix Duncan Trussell and Pendleton Ward show, The Midnight Gospel.
Oh, we haven't really talked about chapter two of all this because you had just started it and I was begrudgingly watching it. And then
right. There
came one episode that I think both of us just needed to take a moment after.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it because I think the whole buildup to it is very important. But I will say, like, as someone who really enjoyed the show, I was even heightened by the thing that it does near the end of that show. And I think it's very, not a lot of people are able to do that and have the thing that they have in there. So I think it is.
I've not been able to watch another episode since then. Cause I watched that one twice and I've held it and thought about it quite a bit, and there'll be a time that I'll turn on and watch more, but to see that, to go from a place of, you know, episode two, we're annoyed by this Arkansas, you know, magic philosopher, whatever, to where we end up, it ended up being very, very powerful. I think it's very worthy.
Yeah.
Okay. So
what's up?
Yeah, Mike. So I tried. I got like 10 minutes into the first episode and I'm like, what is this, like an effing podcast that's been animated? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm listening to Dr. Drew go on about the psychological benefits of marijuana. And I'm like, do I need to be high to watch this? Cause like, I'm like old man here, not getting it.
Well, and it is a podcast that's been animated. And
oh, there we go.
And so, and I enjoy that part of it. I really enjoy like that gives it a very different tone and a very dense tone that even with like adult animation now we don't see as much of. And I think it's really cool seeing all these different viewpoints and perspectives. But I totally like I definitely the first couple of episodes before I realized that is what it was, which were these old podcasts that had been reshaped into fitting into these animated stories and these visual stories. Like I was bewildered at what the proposition was. But I think it's worth.
Is the one with his mom the last one of all of them? Is that the ending?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess I did see the entire run. Man, what an ending. What an ending.
Yeah. And it's, for only being what, like eight half-hour episodes, I wouldn't necessarily say it's an easy watch because it's very dense and because it's very visual. Objectively speaking, relatively quick.
I'll definitely give another shot. I definitely, because yeah. I just was like, I'm looking for some more fun animated kind of thing. I'm like, I want something kind of fun. And
yeah.
It's like, my curious to hear what you guys think of at this point, but like, I'm like three episodes into Solar Opposites and like, what a dark, dark bean show. You know, like, this is like, it's just like, I don't know who I'm supposed to like here.
Oh, you're having trouble with Solar Opposites?
Nobody's likable. They're all oh, awful. It's just people murdered left and right. It's just sort of like the murder joke just for the murder joke kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, to me, I'm like, I'll keep watching it, but I'm like, just like, I don't know. It's like those sense of repercussions or whatever. And I just sort of feel like it's just kind of going more for, you know, I think Roiland's a genius. And so I can't begin to comprehend, and I'm maybe not sophisticated enough, but I'm like, man, like, just like a lot of throat slashing and people just being murdered for kind of just as a punchline. Like,
which is weird, because I feel like that show goes out of its way. We're getting off topic here, but I feel like that show goes out of its way to like also try to revive dead people, or like dead meaningless characters, in a very kind of weird way.
I will say that I anticipate you will, the majority of your experience with Midnight Gospel, you will actively dislike. But I went through that, and the moments it lands powerfully enough that I'm glad for have watched the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, I like to see people doing something new and different stuff. I want to see it. Like I will make my way through Solar Opposites, even though I'm like, Corvo, as I like to say, 2/3 Rick, you know, is, you know, got another plan kind of thing. And it's hard to shake the thing that it's, you know, it's so emulative. It's so reminds you of, because so much of it comes from there, but then it's missing, you know, part of, I think, the heart of the other thing. But with Midnight Gospel, like, yeah, I will go back and try a thing again and again to get into it, because I want to see the value I didn't see before. And often I'm surprised and delighted.
Yeah. And it's not, I think, Brian, I mean, I would not call it comedy. It's not
Midnight Gospel.
Funny. Yeah.
Well,
it's not haha funny.
No. It's a podcast. If also in the background, the movie Heavy Metal happened to be on, and you notice times things seem to line up. That's what it is.
Yeah. So, do you have a pick, Andrew?
My pick is sort of basically like, do check out Solar Opposites. You know, I'm curious to see other people's take on it. You know, I'm there's a lot of brilliance. And one of the things that I think that, like, we talked about this before on Rick and Morty, storytelling aside, technically what's going on in animation, these things is fantastic. You know, you go back and you watch the episode last week. It was just incredible from a technical point of view, the quality of the animation, you know, all the things going on, et cetera. And so that's one of the things I do appreciate, is just where, how good, really good, the technical part of animation can be right now.
Yeah. I finished Solar Opposites last week. I really dig it. It's definitely like, lighter fare than Rick and Morty. It is more in the vein of a Family Guy or an American Dad rather than, say, an Adult Swim show. I thought it was nice and light in a nice way. I don't know. And I kind of like the other alien, Terry. I kind of thought he was likable.
Yeah, they're just not, it is not interesting, I guess. I guess that's a sort of my thing, is that it's just that at this point, and I'm going to give it a shot, because like, I know my first takes are often completely opposite, you know, and I will go back again, and because I get stuck with the thing in my head and not the thing that's in front of me. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.